First of all, growth. Growth. One could also say growing. The image, the form of growing is, of course, the plant. And plant imagery, we know, figures very prominently in Buddhism, very, very prominently in Buddhist tradition and literature and teaching. Think of the Buddha's initial vision of humanity when he sat under that Bodhi tree after the Enlightenment, if Enlightenment has an after. And he looked out over the whole world. He saw the whole of humanity. And how did he see them? He saw them, we are told, as a great bed of lotuses stretching in all directions. Lotuses in different stages of development. Some sunk down in the mud, some halfway up through the water, some risen to the surface, some standing in the sunlight with opened petals, drinking in the light of the sun. He saw all living beings in this way as plants, lotuses, in different stages of development. And we may say that this great vision of humanity as a bed of lotus plants, this great vision stayed with Buddhism throughout its 2,500 years of history. We know that in Buddhism, in the course of centuries upon centuries, there were many great philosophical developments. We know that in all conscience they were sometimes dry and abstract enough. We know there was much of scholasticism, much of formalism crept into Buddhism later on. But Buddhism never forgot, never in any area, in any part of the Buddhist world, quite forgot at any time the Buddha's great vision of that bed of lotuses standing there in the early morning sunlight. As he saw them after his enlightenment. Buddhism never forgot that image of growth, of growing. And the image assumed many different forms. We think, for instance, of the lotus throne, that many-petaled lotus throne on which Buddhas and transcendental bodhisattvas innumerable sit and teach and meditate and radiate. We think of the refuge tree, that great tree, that great lotus tree with a central trunk and four great branches, on all of which are many-tiered, many-petaled lotus flowers, on which again sit Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, Arahants, Gurus, Yidams, and Dakinis. And we think, perhaps above all, of the White Lotus Sutra's great parable of the herbs and the plants, also known as the parable of the rain cloud. And this parable, or the Buddha in this parable, sees humanity as being like plants of many different kinds. Not just all lotuses even, but all sorts, all kinds of plants, shrubs, trees, herbs, grass, large and small, simple and complex. And when the rain of the Dharma falls out of that thundering rain cloud in the midst of the sky, when the rain of the Dharma falls with universal refreshment, then they all grow, all those plants, all those trees, herbs, shrubs, grasses, but they all grow. And here is the great addition to the teaching in this parable. They all grow in their own way, according to their own individual natures. The grass becomes still more beautiful grass. The tree becomes a more abundant and many-leaved tree. The flower becomes a still more beautiful flower. The shrub, a more splendid shrub. They all grow according to their own individual natures. In this great parable of the White Lotus Sutra, when they receive the rain of the Dharma. So no need to multiply examples. This is an aspect of the Dharma that I've dealt with more than once before. So we can say, I think, that there are quite a number of advantages in thinking of religion, if we do have to use that word, and frankly I'd rather not, thinking of it in terms of growth rather than in terms of experience, in seeing ourselves, feeling ourselves as plants, drinking in the Dharma like the rain. Growth is a total thing. All of us is growing all at the time, or should be growing. There's no question of working our way up to growth. The process is absolutely continuous. Growth doesn't lie at the end, or only at the end, of the process. If we are working our way up, we are growing. All effort is growth. Religion, again to use that word, the spiritual life, is like the plant. And enlightenment is the flower. In a sense, the flower is separate from the plant. But also, in another sense, perhaps not another sense, the flower is part of the plant. The flower is a natural product, the culmination of the growth of the plant itself. It cannot be stuck onto the plant from outside prematurely before the plant has reached the appropriate stage of development, when the flower naturally comes forth. So the plant, we may also say, is the path, and the flower is the goal. And you can reach the goal only by following the path. You cannot grab the goal as if it were apart from following the path. The goal is no more separate from the path than the flower is separate from the plant. A great image, that of the plant and the flower. But images, however beautiful, however appropriate, also have their limitations. All right, we are plants. We grow. We burst into bloom even. We gain enlightenment. But a flower fades. A flower loses its petals. But the spiritual life is not like that. So we have to stretch our imaginations quite a bit further. We have to expand and develop our image. And we have to say that when the flower of enlightenment blooms, that flower does not fade. Its petals do not fall. The rest of the plant may drop away, the stalk, the leaves. But that flower remains on its own, remains, as it were, suspended in the sky, floating. We could even say that the whole plant had become flower. Moreover, this flower, like other flowers, contains seeds. And as that flower is suspended there, floats there in the sky, in the heavens, those seeds grow into plants. All those plants produce flowers. And all those flowers, too, remain suspended, floating in the sky, in the heavens. So that eventually, as this process continues and continues and continues throughout infinity and eternity, the whole of space becomes filled with flowers. This is the kind of vision we see in some kinds of meditation. The whole of space filled with a vast network of flowers. Great flowers, golden lotus flowers. And all the time that network is expanding. It's expanding to infinity in all directions. That great golden network of lotus flowers. That's what the Buddhist life is really like. Anyway, time we came down to earth, back to a sense of space and time. Time we got back to the plant. Time we got back to the individual, struggling to grow. Back, that is to say, to ourselves. As the parable of the herbs and plants reminds us, the plant needs rain. But it needs quite a number of other things too, if it is to grow. It needs sunshine. It needs perhaps wind. It needs soil, with everything that the soil contains. It needs even so humble a thing as manure. Maybe it needs a bit of pruning from time to time, a bit of trimming. or protection from creepy crawly things, or protection from wild animals. It may even, if it is not too proud to disdain the aid, it may need even a stick to support it for a while. In other words, growth depends on a complex of favourable conditions. And this brings us to a very important point indeed. To the point, to the fact that we need to situate this business of growth, this process of growth, within a wider and ever wider context. And this means, again, a much fuller and richer conception of Buddhism itself. Buddhism is not just ethics, not just meditation, great and important as meditation is. Buddhism is a lot more things than those two. Buddhism is a doctrine, a teaching, even a philosophy. It's a myth, a whole series of great myths. It's a body of legends. It's social institutions. It's festivals and celebrations. It's art, or the arts. It's ritual, and it's work. And as Buddhists, we need to be nourished by all of these things. We may need more of some than of others, depending, of course, on the kind of plant we are. And in the same way, we need, as Mr. Humphreys has suggested in the course of his opening remarks, we need all the different forms of Buddhism. Not in the rather mutually exclusive, occasionally sectarian form in which they exist in at least some parts of the East. We need what is essential in them all, what is basic in them all, what is living in them all, what is nourishing in them all to us as we try to grow in the light of Buddhism here in the West. Perhaps the tree Yana Buddhism of Tibet offers us a model here. Tibetan Buddhism is unprecedentedly rich, but of course, in the case of Tibetan Buddhism, there is the danger of exoticism, the danger that we'll be drawn more by the colourful garb than by the living universal spiritual essence. And in any case, of course, it is significant that Tibetan Buddhism, at least in some quarters, has begun perhaps to replace Zen as the single most popular form of Buddhism in the West, Europe and America. It's a sign, perhaps, that Western Buddhists no longer get sufficient nourishment either from the dry bones of contemporary Theravada or the cold tea leaves of modern Zen. Perhaps, and this is only a suggestion, perhaps the Tiantai Buddhism of China would be an even better model for us and to us than Tibetan Buddhism. And of course, the Tiantai Buddhism of China continued in Japan as the Tendai tradition, one of the smallest schools there today, is not tree yana, it is ekayana. Not three ways, even though convergent, but one from the beginning, in principle.